This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our show today is devoted to Sam Phillips, one of the most important figures in the behind-the-scenes history of rock and roll. He died yesterday of respiratory failure at the age of 80. Phillips discovered and was the first to record Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Charlie Rich. He recorded them on his Memphis-based record label, Sun Records, which he founded in 1952. In a few minutes, we'll hear a 1997 interview with Phillips. Earlier today, we called the music writer Peter Guralnick, who wrote a two-volume history of Elvis Presley and produced a documentary about Phillips. How would you describe the sound that he created with his record label, Sun Records?
I think the sound that Sam aimed at was something that was loose, spontaneous, free. I mean, Sam prided himself as an audio engineer, and he was very, very particular about microphone placement in particular. But what he was most concerned with was creating an atmosphere in the studio that allowed the artist to relax and to offer up his or her very best contribution. He recognized from the outset that this was an unnatural process to put somebody in front of a microphone, somebody who probably at most had sung for his or her own family at home, maybe had sung, you know, on a stage, on a local stage for friends. But the idea of actually commemorating this, of creating a sound that might last an eternity, was something that could immediately put people off. And Sam's entire emphasis was to create an atmosphere in which not only was the person doing the recording, did the person feel relaxed, but they felt as if they were going to have an experience that was going to be fun. Sam emphasized that above everything else. If it wasn't fun, it wasn't worth doing.
Was Sam Phillips a kind of odd mix of laid back and driven? Laid back in the sense that I know in the studio he really prized like relaxation and just, you know, being in the moment and having a kind of spontaneous sounding performance. And it sounded like he wasn't a high-pressure guy in the studio. On the other hand, he really had to drive himself to start that label and to keep it going. And you've said he sacrificed a lot in order to be able to do it.
No, I think that's right. I think Sam was very much a mix of someone who, as Marion Keisker, his assistant at Sun Records, said, Sam was not a patient man, but he showed extraordinary patience in the studio. He was very much a driven man, and what drove him most of all was this sense of mission. The sense that what he was doing was enormously important, the sense that he wanted to communicate to the world, he wanted to communicate to the nation at large how great this African-American culture with which he had grown up, you know, on the farm in Alabama, in Memphis, on Beale Street, how much this had to offer. And he was determined to do it against all odds. And he said again and again, he said, I just would have been, if I hadn't done it, if I hadn't been willing to risk anything, to risk everything, I wouldn't have been worth anything because I believed in it so much. And so he went out and he did it. He went out and but he believed so strongly in individuality and difference and in nonconformity and uniqueness. I mean, he spoke about Howlin' Wolf's voice and he said, you know, it was so bad, it was the best voice I ever heard. And he meant that. You know, the two artists that he spoke of as admiring the most were Charlie Rich and Howlin' Wolf, and you couldn't find two more different artists in the world, but it was because they were expressing something so unique from within themselves. He was almost a prophet. He was driven in that sense, and his prophecy was, wake up, America. You've got to wake up. Don't allow yourself to drift into a dream of conformity, into a dream of just doing what everybody wants you to do, of being becoming the prisoner of fame, of baubles, of fashion. Follow your own dream. Follow your own mind. He says, and if we don't do that, and if we don't wake up soon, then one of these days we're just going to wake up and we're going to be in prison and we're not even going to know it.
Was he an easy man to be comfortable around? Were you kind of like relaxed around him when you started to get to know him, or did it take a while before you felt comfortable and relaxed in his presence?
Sam prided himself on his unpredictability.
Uh-huh.
So I would say relaxing around Sam, I think after a while, he would say to me sometimes, he says, it took me a long time to get used to you. And I said, well, good, I'm glad you finally got used to me. I mean, I felt that we became good friends and we could speak, you know, we could certainly speak. Sam was always going to speak his mind, but You know, I felt that I could speak my mind in my own way. But no, I mean, Sam could always throw you off, and he delighted in the sense in not being predictable himself and not allowing you to get too comfortable around him. But at the same time, he was a person who could show tremendous affection and who could show tremendous support for those he really cared about.
What's one of the most unpredictable things he did or said in your presence?
Oh boy, I don't know. I being with Sam it was always a wonderful ride. You know, you might be there with somebody might show up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and Sam would say, "Now, do you think you're good enough for her?" Now, I don't know about this, you know. He said, "What have you got to offer her? I know her, and she is really, you know, she's a fine woman," and, you know, so, I mean, he didn't really care. You know, it was like when he went on David Letterman, and he felt that, I mean, this was a source of great shame to many Memphians because people felt that he had disgraced himself, but he went on David Letterman, and he didn't like the line of question, and whether Sam had had a few drinks or not, it had really had nothing to do with it. He was going to say exactly what he felt like saying, and when Letterman, he felt he was being patronized, I think, by Letterman. And just at some point, he just turned to Letterman and he says quizzically, he says, "David, did anyone ever tell you you should have your teeth fixed?" And the end of that show was, you know, Letterman saying, "Say goodnight, Sam," and David, and Sam being ushered off the show. But I saw him with Rufus Thomas maybe a week or two later, and Rufus was asking him how he could get booked onto the Letterman show. And I sort of started laughing, thinking that Sam's, you know, Sam took a negative view of the experience. But Sam just said, "Rufus," he says, "those people on the Letterman show were some of the nicest people I've ever met. I mean, let me tell you, you know, they treated me like a prince." And then he's giving Rufus names, and he was perfectly serious about that too. I guess the greatest moment was when he got booed off the stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think it was the second year it was going, and he got up there and he was giving this speech about. I think he was inducting Carl Perkins. I don't know who he was inducting. He was inducting somebody. But he got off on the fact that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be in Memphis. And he said, "Now listen, those people in Cleveland, they're some of the finest people I know. I mean, Cleveland, it's a wonderful city. Now don't make any mistake about this. I'm not putting down Cleveland, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be in Memphis." You know? Meanwhile, all the Cleveland people were there, and he was booed and just, you know, hissed off the stage. But again, he just didn't care. He was, you know, he was determined to express himself.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to, always glad to talk to you.
Peter Guralnick is the author of a 2-volume biography of Elvis Presley.